All right, let us
just
dive.
Like Ron Burgundy over there. It was written on the sheet.
You normally change the thing. It's a dynamic system. It is Thursday, June 13th, and at a party in Anmore, there were 7 supercars, 5 hypercars, and 3 fucking helicopters. This is the Camby Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And today we are joined by Zoe Ferry of Hello. Majority of BC. Welcome, Zoe.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
So what's Majority of BC, the podcast?
We talk about, well, a lot of provincial stuff. We cover mostly liberal politics in the provincial side. It's a coalition of federal liberals and federal conservatives who love to discuss all of the things that go on in the legislature and our caucus.
And the majority of BC represents
the majority of people who voted in favor of a liberal government, is what they're saying.
So it's the plurality of
BC. The plurality, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was the majority that didn't vote for the NDP.
Yeah, I think that was the original, like...
Yeah, it's...
It's an imperfect name.
Plurality of BC doesn't sound quite...
It doesn't have the ring.
Speaking of rightward drift, hard a starboard, boys. I leave for 2 episodes and you become Marx and Engels. Like, geez.
Which one do I get to be?
Yeah, I don't know. Am I the one that's going to give you money into my retirement because you're broke?
Or am I Groucho?
Oh, yeah.
No, it was good. I thought we had a lot of fun. We got to blame everything on capitalism. But now you're back and we've helped balance the show a little bit for an episode and we'll see where we go from here.
Well, we've super balanced the show now. We've got 2 longstanding members of the federal and BC Liberal parties. And so it should, in theory, be fairly balanced.
Dear listeners, we want to ask you to help us improve the podcast. We've started launching surveys for Patreon supporters and for general listeners. As a general listener, if you haven't already completed the survey, go to cambyreport.ca, fill out the questions, and we may or may not improve the show based on what you say.
Yeah, I think it's a real value to touch base with our listeners every once in a while. We're really trying to grow our audience and really trying to improve what we can provide. And so this is a real opportunity for you to get in and let us know, you know, is our show length too long, too short?
So cambyreport.ca/survey, fill that out. And if you want to get more access to other special events, like the brunch we just had this past weekend.
Where we gathered at Craft Tap House or in whatever it's called in the Olympic Village at 10:30 in the morning. And had
what time did you leave?
Well, at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a couple of the other people that were there, who are also big hockey fans, pointed out that at 5 o'clock was the hockey game. And so we did that, and then I stumbled home at about 8:30 at night.
So if you want to spend an entire Sunday at a bar drinking with Patrick.
It was a real blast. We had about 20 people there and real fun.
So go to patreon.com/CambyReport and sign up for info about the next brunch.
Yes, that's patreon.com/CambyReport.
Oh, and Ian, you dropped a Patreon-only episode just last week, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a little interview that I did with one of the members of the Alliance Against Displacement in Burnaby. I want to get more takes on how this Burnaby approach to tenants is going, and that's kind of the first interview. It was a very critical one where I think we've heard a lot of people cheer Burnaby's bold steps, and I'm hopefully going to get a few more interviews. Those will go up on there, and then we'll hopefully get that Burnaby episode out eventually.
Let us dive right in with the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Report. Now, it has some implications and recommendations for municipalities, but we thought that we would focus on some of the things individual listeners could do, because this is a really important report, and we're going to discuss actually some of the more legal implications tomorrow on our episode of Spirits of the Law, so stay tuned for that. Ian will be visiting for that discussion, but individually, what can we do?
Yeah, the report is 231 recommendations. It's a 1,200-page report. The executive summary is 120 pages, which we were discussing before, and Patrick, as a policy researcher, really likes one-pagers that are brief and to the point.
Honestly, I'll read a 40-page document, no problem.
Okay. Matthew, as a lawyer, enjoys...
I'm not a lawyer. anyway.
Sorry. An articling student at a law firm enjoys the longer form.
You literally called it a short executive summary.
Yeah, it's not that long. It's
the report, though, we have to remember, is in this context of this high disproportionate number of Indigenous women and girls and 2S LGBTQIA peoples who are going missing and have been found murdered. And those murders are often going unsolved. And it's an attempt to answer why. BC's done similar reports in the past, and the recommendations always kind of come back the same, that there are a lot of systemic issues here relating to poverty, lack of safe transportation options. This one goes nice and far and just lays it out that put this all together and Canada is culpable in a genocide of Indigenous peoples, and that generates its own debate. But let's bring it back to the recommendations for individuals, because there's 231 recommendations, and what can we all do? I think there's about 15 for individuals. They start with very simple things like acknowledging that this violence is happening against women, girls, and 2S LGBTQIA peoples.
Commendations, by the way, on the accuracy of that particular alphabet soup acronym.
For those who haven't followed that one, it's Two-Spirit, Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Queer, Questioning, Intersex, and Asexual. And Community has a great glossary of the rainbow of terms that are out there that can be really useful for those who haven't come across them.
That's Community, right?
Yes.
Yes.
The other recommendations for individuals are largely around just trying to learn more. Reading the report is a great start, whether it's the full report or at least the executive summary. I know for myself, I put some effort into reading parts of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report, and I've done the same for this. Talking to Indigenous people and Indigenous women, making friends, it seems very almost simple, but those kind of human connections can really make that difference in ending this violence and just trying to basically speak out against it.
I think, yeah, it really does make you think. And I think that we as a society really need to own up to the fact that this violence is still ongoing. You know, it's really, really common that people will say, well, you know, it's all in the past, we need to move forward. But in reality, it's still happening. And I think that's something that needs to be acknowledged.
It's a very complicated set of emotions for me because my cousin is like one of the statistics in this report. She was murdered a couple of decades ago in a murder-suicide. But it's like part of the systemic violence. And it really... intergenerational trauma is something that isn't experienced like as intergenerational trauma. Intergenerational trauma is a sociological term, but to the individuals experiencing these events, it's a personal tragedy. And so like this complex set of factors that go into creating a system where people end up dying and going missing, like it sometimes doesn't even feel like it from within the system, but like it's a horror that like only broad societal awareness of the system is going to be able to change.
I mean, I think it always gets said, but when incidents like this happen and reports like this come out, the basics are something that everyone forgets because you don't really think about how you treat people until it's black and white in front of you. And this report really highlighted that a lot, like the Aboriginal communities in this country are really isolated compared to a lot of other minority groups we have. No one thinks about when a synagogue is attacked, no one questions it. No one thinks about what happens on the reservations outside of this report. So it's a good reminder that this is the largest group we have, and this is still the most horrific incidents that we've ever had happen in this country.
I think you really touched on it well there, is why they call it systemic and why they, and we're going to get into it, why they called it a genocide, is if you have a systemic pattern of police not taking seriously the murder of a group of people, of an ethnic group of people, well, that is essentially state-sanctioned violence at that point, because the state is saying, well, we're not going to really work too hard to find who's killing these people. And if you're doing that consistently, and that's regularly the case, I don't know what else to call that other than a state-run genocide.
I would actually even like step back and say that it's a social genocide. Like it's not state-run specifically. It's not like, you know, the actual state-run genocide that John A. MacDonald ran on the prairies, but it is a system of malicious neglect. And it really makes me realize why William Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet in Italy and not set in England, because he's making social commentary, and it's like very difficult to do this about your own society when you're living in it. And so making social commentary as some kind of allegory, I feel like there's a really broad opening for a way that Canadians can like actualize our horror at what we've done artistic form. So
I'm gonna push back on you just a little bit on that, though. Is I think you said that, you know, it's because the state's not doing it in the active manner, but we do know that the state is doing things like disproportionately taking children away from Indigenous parents at a level that is really quite horrific, and we're not providing any supports to allow people to raise their own children. And so that itself is a form of genocide too, right? When you're taking the children away from an ethnic group.
It's one of these challenges where every individual in the system seems to think, or likely thinks, they're operating with the best of intentions. And, you know, I'm looking out for this child, and, you know, I've considered adopting a child before. And if I go through the foster system here, it's likely to be an Indigenous child who's been taken from a family. And what is the morality around that? I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's better that a child has a home than doesn't, but not if it's taken. But, you know, it's not my fault in that situation.
Yeah.
It's that systemic, there's no one person guiding the hand of the policy here, but it's that collective problem
this is my point, is that it's a system of people who are like fumbling towards genocide, unfortunately. Like there are some people who are absolutely malicious actors, and like there are police officers who have directly done malicious and bad things, but there are also police officers who, through, again, I will use the term malicious neglect, or even like just straight up negligence rather than some kind of racist motivation, have allowed the system to perpetuate. And I think that can be distinguished from like an actual state sponsored like act of genocide. But like this is, again, it's splitting hairs. And this is the problem with the term. It's because people end up focusing on the term rather than the system and how we can change it. Because like, I think, with or without the term genocide, I think everyone can realize that the thing is a horrific and monstrous historical and current crime that we are continuing to perpetuate.
And that's where the recommendations are so important. You know, I've talked about a couple for individuals. There's a page or two for media that we're reflecting on ourselves and what we can do. We haven't done a ton.
There's ways that we have met some of those, and we consistently tried to, but there's ways that we need to be better. And, you know, it's something that we always strive to do, right? And we're gonna take a look at those recommendations and take them to heart.
Yeah.
It was fascinating, though. You're right, though, Matthew, is that this became a discussion around the word. And I really question why people would get mad about the use of that word. I think the word genocide, I think, is applicable. But even if it's not applicable, why is it that there are people that will fixate on that term as the reason why they don't like the report?
It's because it's reductio ad Hitlerium, or whatever. It's people are like, genocide is what Hitler did, and I'm not Hitler, therefore I can't do genocide.
Directly relating it to a different genocide, as though all genocides can meet certain check marks, right?
Well, and you could really tell it's that level of analysis, because many of these think piece type approaches were written before the report was officially even out. John Kay's like attack started on Twitter just because he's heard the word, and he's like, that can't be, we didn't have gas chambers, or, you know, the numbers aren't big enough.
And then he said, we're gonna need a new term for the Holocaust and Holodomor, and you're like, no, we have those terms. Those are terms already.
So it's been exhausting.
Yeah, and it's hard to go through these conversations.
And like this is why I find the Vikings kind of informative here.
Just every time, you know, like, this isn't criticism. I think that's every, like, when you're like William Shakespeare, I'm just like, where is this going?
I thought it was a good point.
I'm really curious where the Vikings are going now. The TV show, or the Viking, or the people?
Well, Viking was more of a job, but like the Scandinavians of the like turn of the millennium were a kind of decentralized, they didn't have like specific kings. It was like a group of people who came over to like northern France and down the Volga River and into Scotland. And those individuals acting as individuals killed a bunch of people. And that arguably was a kind of decentralized social genocide as well. And so I don't think that any Canadians are specifically thinking of themselves as like marauding bandits, but we are people who are like going off into a land where our ancestors were not born and looking for resources. So I don't think the parallels are necessarily not there. All right. So from turn of the millennium Norway back to Vancouver, the homelessness count was recently completed, and we have some updates on that. Patrick.
Yeah, so the homelessness count is done every year, and you know, hundreds of volunteers get together, and they basically comb the streets and ask people that are living on the streets some essentially statistical questions. It's a census, essentially, so that we get a sense of what the issues are, who's on the street, and why. And this year's came out, and there was a lot of hope this year that it would come out as being less than last year. You know, we've now housed 600 people in temporary modular housing in Vancouver, and then hundreds more people outside of Vancouver. So the hope was that it would decrease. And there was a 2% increase in the number of homeless people that were found. Amongst those, to give some statistics to the conversation, is 39% of the homelessness people that were identified themselves as Indigenous. So speaking to that missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and genocide, you know, there are 2% of Metro Vancouver's population are Indigenous, and 39% of our homeless people in the city of Vancouver are Indigenous. And that's stark and telling. Further, 44% said they had a mental health condition or illness, which, again, you know, we know Riverview was an important component to the mental health system in British Columbia. And I'm not flagging any provincial government, because subsequent repeated provincial governments closed down more sections of it. Those are things that we need to bring back. 38% said they had a physical disability. And 81% said they lived in the city of Vancouver before they became homeless, which really plays against the trope that all the homeless people of, you know, Western Canada come to Vancouver because of the weather. And so it's, you know, obviously it's dark to hear all these, but it's really important that we know who is out there and what we can do to support them.
Yeah, I actually, like, as a Calgarian, I get kind of annoyed at the characterization of the Alberta policy to, like, Alberta puts all their homeless people on buses and sends them to Vancouver, and that wasn't what was happening.
They only put some homeless people on some buses and sent them to Vancouver.
It's just that the premier said he was going to do it.
Yes, well, he said that people who were from BC who wanted to go to BC could have a ticket back, because transportation is outrageously expensive, and sometimes people come out to Calgary looking for a better life and don't find it and want to go home and can't. It's not like, you know, Ralph Klein was rounding people up and saying, get on the bus.
I mean, he did throw money at homeless people one time, but he was drunk, so it was fine.
That's totally reasonable.
Yeah. So Kennedy Stewart laid the blame for the situation on the federal and provincial governments, as municipal governments are wont to do. And there's a lot of validity there. You know, we've talked about it at the podcast, is social housing taps closed in the 2000s, federally in 1995 and provincially in 2001. And they stopped building social housing in the federal government. Well, I mean, until basically the Trudeau government got elected. And even then, it's been a trickle. And provincially, it didn't start happening until, when was it that Rich Coleman started putting out money for shelters? Something like 2012, 2013?
I think it was.
Yeah. And so, you know, we had a decade and a half or two decades, depending on the level of government, that just chose not to build any social housing. So obviously the problem would get exacerbated.
There's so much in this, and it's one of those things where, like, quickly skimming through the staff report, they don't have a great explanation of why the numbers are so much worse or worse than last year, when they should theoretically be going
600 more people. There have been loss.
I have a theory as to why, and that is that the homelessness count as a metric is kind of inherently flawed. And NPR has done a fairly comprehensive podcast on the series of homeless counts that originated in the United States, which happen usually every January, and then about 11 months later come out with a number which is used for the next year. And it apparently is a kind of flawed process, that for not that much more resources, you could actually have a kind of ongoing real-time collection of information on the number of people who were homeless people in a city. So I think that that's, you know, an aside, but I would encourage people to go listen to, I can't remember whether it was Planet Money or The Indicator, but my thoughts are probably Planet Money. And it was about a month, 3 weeks ago that they had this podcast.
So the city is continuing on some strategies. They're hell-bent on essentially taking over as many of the SROs and revamping them and making them not run by the Sahotas as they can over time. There has been a loss of shelter in Vancouver over the last year, as was highlighted by Gene Swanson. And so there are issues that are still at play here where we're losing shelter. But gradually, I think we're getting to a point where there's more and more of it coming online.
Well, there's also more of a focus, too, I think, with development projects now in the city, where you're not just looking at people who can't afford to rent, it's people who can't afford to live. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing that with the temporary modular housing, there's more of it going up in areas that are not in there next to the downtown east side, which is exactly where they need to be built. And it might be an unpopular opinion, but...
And recent report came out saying that the Marpole temporary modular housing has had no meaningful impact on the policing calls in the neighborhood, much to the surprise of all of the residents that nearly rioted to oppose it.
Well, I think it was a very vocal group of parents that rioted, not necessarily the overall community.
Mm-hmm. And ironically, their students were on the, or their kids were on the other side of the...
Is that ironic or just the modern world?
I feel like that's every generation has that.
I think that's a Sarah McLachlan-style ironic.
Oh,
I think it's Alanis
Morissette. Oh my God, that's Alanis Morissette.
Sarah McLachlan.
There is no way you're editing that out.
She's singing. One of them is singing tonight at the game.
Sarah McLachlan is singing at the game. Alanis Morissette. Seg ironic.
My bad.
Pop culture.
Canadian card gone.
But with all these protests and the fact numbers have gone up, you can imagine some people saying, oh, what have they even accomplished? But it kind of highlights... If we hadn't built everything,
how much more would it have been? Yeah. And is it also a question of people just finally giving up and not being able to afford at all? There was the hidden homeless rate increases, and it's not as talked about. But with the rent the way it is it just because people really can't afford to live in the city at all now, and this is their only option? So I think that talks about an issue that we don't hear about a lot with the homeless count I've found now.
So when I was doing some postgrad work on planning, I did my report on homelessness and unaffordability in Vancouver, and it was right before the 2014 thing where everything went insane, and so it was this brief snapshot in time. But even then, it was I was saying something like 50% of all homes in Vancouver at every income level are unaffordable, according to government statistics. And then things only got worse, and wages didn't rise accordingly. So I can't imagine things are much better now.
Well, changing the channel from the homelessness count to changing the check day is, I think, our next transition. We've got a motion.
C-.
Yeah, that's fair. That's trying hard. I was trying, we've got Councillor Sarah Kirby-Young has a motion at council called Change the Check Day. This is based off of a big push being made by MLA Jane Thornthwaite from North Vancouver Seymour. And the idea is to vary the welfare check rate, as well as to potentially shift some people to monthly checks or some people to weekly checks.
The check date, right?
Oh, sorry.
The check rate.
The check date.
A BC Liberal wouldn't ever consider raising them. Mm.
So the famous sort of Welfare Wednesday concept, where the welfare checks are issued on Wednesdays.
And there is a measurable increase in police calls and overdoses on that day.
No, absolutely. And so that's one of the arguments in favor of it. And so there is a lot of pushback inside of the Downtown Eastside community from it. A lot of the counter arguments, and I'm going to be sitting down with Karen Ward, I think, fairly soon. She's a Downtown Eastside advocate, to talk about it from her perspective. But from what I basically heard is, a lot of nonprofits and a lot of organizations that provide support are able to sort of staff up for that day and be ready rather than a situation where it's always on. As well, the issue isn't necessarily what day the checks are cut. It's what amounts of support are there. It's what mechanisms there are to help people. It's at the end of the day, I think it's safe to say that the problem is poverty and not what day you're issuing the check. Yeah, so it's an interesting motion. There's some evidence behind it, but there's also some controversy.
It's one of these motions for me that kind of highlights the difference between the top down, I sit from afar, look at this and go, oh, well, what if we made this better? Versus when you talk to the people who are directly affected and living it, they understand all those same issues, but want it that way. And I think at least understanding that perspective is so important before kind of bringing forward these motions and thinking about and making these suggestions that, oh, clearly, and I don't think anyone's painting it as a silver bullet to solving, you know, overdose crises and things. But when the advocates in the downtown east side are not asking for this, I think that bears consideration at least.
Yeah, I looked around. I wasn't able to find any real downtown east side organizations that have been in support of it. And so that always makes me pause whenever a politician, not even from the area affected, is raising an issue. But I will say it was very confusing watching an MLA from not Vancouver at a Vancouver City Council meeting.
Well, there is also some action on a drug that you can't overdose on in the downtown east side. Cannabis does not cause overdoses, and yet we still wish to control it, even though it is legal. Our prohibition regime trundles on in a different monster form. What is happening?
This one's an interesting one. It's from Councillor Bly. Once again, this is, you know, the phrase, you know, not your parents' NPA. You know, we didn't traditionally see NPA come out with a regular raft of changes meant to assist the downtown east side historically. And now we've got a very different group of councillors.
So NPA, not your parents' association of nonpartisan association.
So, with that said, so Councilor Black, essentially, there is the intent at the city to not allow any cannabis sales in terms of retail sales in the downtown east side area, similar to how they bar alcohol sales or did bar for a while alcohol sales in the downtown east side. And Councilor Black is essentially asking to relook at that policy.
Yeah, there's a weird exclusion zone. I saw the map drawn out that they basically said
it's literally called the exclusion zone.
And I think there, it had initially been reported as there will be no cannabis sales in there, but then there's technically already a couple pre-approved, but it won't be a craft market level saturation that might happen in Kitsilano or other areas in the city. Not that cannabis has moved quickly.
Yeah, I feel like the worry of a craft market might happen in about 5 years when they finally get through all those permits.
That's possible. And Sarah Blythe has been former Parks Board Commissioner, a regular person who works in the downtown east side on this issue, has been a supporter of Councillor Bly's motion. She also was running for a long time, essentially what was at the time illegal distribution service where people would essentially exchange harder drugs for cannabis from her. And that got in the news when her cannabis was seized by the police for being illegal, something like 2 weeks before legalization day. But yeah, it's an interesting motion. I think it's well worth considering, and it's neat to see this council come up with very unique ideas.
I think that, like, number one, that's a great policy. Like, that's a great program that she was running, and I think that more of that would be very helpful. It's like a form of harm reduction.
Yeah, literally.
Like, mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's more effective than anything that has been put out there so far.
Yeah. Well, and Bly's motion calls for low-cost cannabis as well. She has some kind of a community service mechanism or method or like a co-op of some kind so that it's not a significant expense. And it's you know, well worth considering, I think.
So to be clear, the exclusion zone exists currently or is planned for like the permitting process? It's a permitting guideline?
If I'm understanding it right, it's essentially applying the already existing liquor exclusion zone from liquor sales to cannabis.
Okay.
And the liquor exclusion zone is also not without its detractors and people that think that it shouldn't exist as well.
Yeah, okay. But a report came out today saying that like the amount of deaths related to alcohol in Canada is a silent epidemic. And
oh, certainly, yeah.
And people don't die from cannabis. Like,
yep.
Comparatively, it's very, very safe. Like, the fact that we invented civilization because we like to get drunk is neither here nor there. But, like, applying a standard or, like, an exclusion zone for a drug that does not have the same, like, violence-inducing or health-impacting effects as alcohol does is very wrongheaded. So I'm very pleased to see such a motion coming forward. Good for you, Councillor Bly.
Continuing on the same general theme, but moving on to Maple Ridge.
Yeah, speaking of harm reduction, one of the things Sarah Blythe is famous for is working on what were overdose prevention sites in the downtown east side, essentially. Activists set up spaces where people were told, you can do your drugs here and we will have people here to save your life if you overdose. They'll have naloxone kits and we will test your drugs. All of this operating in a, it's not even really a legal gray zone because they don't have, they're just operating them illegally because they're trying to save lives.
When there's a bunch of them in the downtown east side that are just allowed to continue to operate.
But not every city is as welcoming of these efforts to prevent people from dying. Maple Ridge, a number of activists have gone there and tried to set up an overdose prevention site. And within hours, the cops were there forcing them to take it down.
This is so surprising and out of the character for Maple Ridge, I have to say. I never would have thought this would happen in Maple Ridge.
Yeah, wait. Maple Ridge has always been a very...
Where is that place again? Sorry, I really... Like, the whole idea of not allowing... They have a huge problem with overdoses.
Yep.
It's comparable to what we have here. And the whole idea of NIMBY and... Would they rather put them on a bus and send them to the downtown east side to go?
That's it. I mean, this is the Anita Place, Maple Ridge tent village, essentially, is where it's been set up. And that tent village is going to be replaced by a temporary modular housing, opposition of the mayor.
Which is about as popular as the overdose.
It's such bullshit because, like, it's such a, like, complete lack of empathy for people who have fallen on hard times.
Yeah.
Because,
good way to put it.
Like, when I was in North Vancouver, we were very focused on, like, a attempt to understand what the needs of the lookout shelter were. And one of the things that was, like, really pushed by the lookout center folks was the people who are homeless in North Vancouver are from North Vancouver. Like, they're not, they're not people who are coming over from the downtown east side. Like, there are people who were North Vancouver residents who want to stay in their community but don't have the resources to have a home anymore. And that's horrific. And also the reason why we need to continue to support affordable housing. But, oh my God, how long have we been banging that drum?
Well, and I also want to give a big shout out to Pivot Legal Society because they were there as this was being set up because they knew where it was inevitably going. And their strategy has been... We will be the legal defense of your attempt to stop people from dying, as we've done in many other places. And they're damn good at it, so...
A lot of practice at this point.
Yeah, unfortunately. But big credit to them. You can check out their Twitter for links to a bunch more, and maybe throw them a couple bucks to help support what is often very expensive work.
Well, hopping back on the bus and heading back towards the Civic Metropole, making a brief stopover in Port Moody...
Because of the breweries, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. But also, let's make sure that those breweries manage to continue to exist, because as I recall from my recent trip out there, they're pretty close to the water. And those rising sea levels might have a bit of an impact on them. What is Port Moody doing about climate change?
So Port Moody's jumped on the climate emergency, I don't want to call it a bandwagon, but the trend of a number of cities...
I don't know, paddle boat?
declarations. Acting Mayor Megan Latty and Councillor Amy Lubick have brought forward a report to form the basis of a motion that just passed actually this week to declare a climate emergency in Port Moody. But what's always interesting is what comes along with that. We've talked a bit about what Vancouver has done. Port Moody seems, I'm pretty excited by it. And so the top line results include things like ensuring 90% of city residents live within an easy walk of their daily needs, setting a goal of 2/3 of trips being done by walking, cycling, or transit by 2030. And this is Port Moody. This isn't downtown Vancouver. Now, they do have a SkyTrain station, and it's a smaller community, but...
Also, I find a lot of people are moving out there because it's cheaper to live out there, so...
Mm-hmm. Although, again, that raises concerns about commute cost and, like... But, you know, buy more trains for the Evergreen line.
That can be a whole conversation, too, about telecommuting versus the need to be in an office environment these days.
Oh, for sure.
And then they're also, of course, going to lobby provincial and federal governments to do their parts. They're going to do a bunch of...
Did it specify what they were going to lobby them to do or what their part was in this?
So one of the things it mentions in one of these articles, because I don't have the full report in front of me, is they do want a diversion of subsidies from fossil fuel companies and a transition... training program for people working in oil and gas.
Very much in line with what the Green and the NDP both came out with in their climate
plans. Green New Deal type thing. Stop subsidizing fossil fuels, use that money to pay workers to do other things. So there are clear paths and objectives in here, which is nice to see. And that those goals, I think, are ambitious for any city, and even if Port Moody is small, being a leader can still be important for the rest of the region.
Well, the global temperature is rising, and so is the temperature in this room. This is a time when we're going to take a brief break and pretend that there's like an ad, for example, that we would read out. But in the meantime...
Oh, thank you.
Well, wasn't it great hearing that audiobook about those mattresses? One thing that you won't find on audible.ca is the rental reports that have been coming out, mostly because they haven't been able to find a good narrator yet. Call me, City of Vancouver. But what do they say?
Well, it's interesting. So the first thing that comes out of this, all of these times that these reports come out, there are some stats that are interesting and worth looking at. So one of the stats is, you know, obviously we know that 3% is considered a healthy vacancy rate. You know, that's an amount where there's enough vacancy that people can reasonably find an apartment if they need to. One of the things that Vancouver has done is they've identified what the vacancy rate is for different tiers of price. And so, for example, anybody want to throw a guess out there what the vacancy rate in the city of Vancouver is for apartments that are valued at less than $750 a month?
Zero.
They exist?
Literally zero. And so, meanwhile, you're up to 1.8% vacancy rate on $2,000 to $4,000 apartments, which, you know...
Isn't shocking because most people don't make money that could afford a $2,000 to $4,000 apartment.
Exactly.
It's also still not a healthy vacancy rate.
Still not a healthy vacancy rate is the other thing. So even rich people have difficulty.
This is exactly what I was saying.
Now, the other two tiers are really interesting. And so at 0.8% vacancy is $1,250 to $2,000. So $1,250 to $2,000 is at 0.8 vacancy, which is the vacancy rate of Vancouver. I don't know about you, but I consider $1,250 to be the upper bound on what's an affordable apartment for most people.
This is a single bed?
This is just this is vacancy rate of private market rental universe by rent range. And then 0.5% for $750 to $1,250. So if you're in a low-income situation, it is very rough. And so they know that. They also highlight that 53% of households in Vancouver, city of Vancouver, are renters and growing. And the reason we know it's growing is because 76% of new household formulation is rental household. So if Vancouver adds 1,000 new households this year, 760 of them will be rental and only 240 will be owned, which is a sign of just how many condos are going up and then being rented by investors, like the condo I live in. So that really says to me that over, you know, if I'm a politician, regardless of if I'm a municipal, federal, or provincial politician, if I'm a politician, I really look at that number and have to start thinking about the people I talk to, because we know that most, the homeowner has always been the larger, you know, body politic, but this is going to change.
Well, and renters have traditionally just been harder to access for politicians. They're yep. more transient. They, I believe, vote at lower rates. And
they
so
do.
It's harder still for politicians to listen now.
Yep. Well, but with 53% of the population being, of a city being renters, that will change. And especially with all of the big companies that are moving in and yep. moving up their offices, that's going to increase a lot more in the next 5 to 10 years.
And we're starting to see a lot more organizing as mm-hmm. well, whether it's Vancouver Tenants Union, or I believe a lot of the people in groups like Abundant Housing Vancouver are renters. People are coming together to try to raise their voice to say, we need housing that's affordable.
And it also like kind of speaks to the shift in paradigm for retirement savings and how like...
I'm sorry, what? Retirement?
What? Right. So
now the RRSP is where you put the money you're going to use on your down payment, because you can pull your RRSP for a down payment. That's what that's for.
I don't.
Okay. So theoretically,
savings.
Like I'm just like I think a couple years older than you, but like once upon a time there was a theoretical point there people could
love story
stop
time.
Working.
What?
When has that been in your lifetime?
No, a theoretical time. It was a myth. It was a myth.
It's like when the dinosaurs walked.
Yeah.
1964, right?
Like, yeah. I know that there are people who are old who don't work. I just assume that...
But they inherited their money, right?
Yeah, that's obviously what happened.
Oh, or it's Alberta and oil dries up. Yeah. And then just people don't work until the boom comes back.
There was a shift in paradigm for, like, now that there are better vehicles for saving for old age, whether you get to retire or not, the old paradigm was that it was the equity in your house that mm-hmm. you would use to draw upon in old age, and now there are other avenues for that, whether it's like a better pension plan or different savings plans. And so a more rental-based economy isn't as terrifying to politicians who are worried about like an old age security bubble coming up and just destroying everything.
So, rental relocation. The issue is that if a rental building is going to be demolished, or there are renters in a building and it's going to be demolished, let's say if my building were going to be demolished, I'm a renter in a condo, there's the rental relocation program. And this is a city-run program that mandates certain requirements by developers and other and owners of property. I should clarify, this doesn't count for renovictions, just demovictions. So if a place is being just renovated, this won't apply. So, communication and engagement. Mandatory meeting between tenants and the applicant with city staff in attendance.
Reasonable.
Seems reasonable.
So, like, I live in a place which has been teetering on the edge of a land assembly for, like, as long as I've lived there. So it doesn't seem to be happening anytime soon. But when it finally happens and they decide to knock the house I live in and all the houses around my house down, there will be a mandatory meeting where some new price is going to be presented to me that is going to be a 20% lower than market rate. Is that the what they were looking at?
The rate of return is at 20%. So that's the current rule is if you get bulldozed out when the new building is built, they have to offer you the ability to move back in at 20% below what they're charging on the market level.
Okay. All right.
So not anything to do with your amount that you were paying at the time.
I'd still be okay with that, but I'm also hopeful that my income will increase. So.
Well, and so, but if you're in a land assembly and it's a townhouse, and they might offer you a unit in the townhouse, a one-bedroom unit in the townhouse, for 20% below $2,700.
That's not a bad deal.
Yeah.
I mean, but if you're renovated out of a place where you're paying $900 a month, and your income is $2,700 a month, 20% off $2,700 a month doesn't work, right? And so that was a real concern, whether or not to go above or beyond that. And so go, 50% below with a market rate or something tied to the unit you were renting. And city staff have recommended against that on the basis of it being too much of a disincentive to development. Essentially, people wouldn't build anything if you did that.
And, like, my house really does need to be knocked down. It shakes when, like, trucks drive by. So
what the city did is essentially they said, city staff basically said, it's going to be nigh on impossible to really help low-income people through a right of refusal or a right of return to your unit. So let's boost the supports to people that get forced out that are of low income or what have you. And so further assistance finding new accommodations, the city is going to work to provide greater support there, as well as for anybody that's facing barriers. So low-income people, et cetera, will get greater support from the city finding a new place. And the city will actually start getting a little bit into the game of actually trying to find places for people, which they don't do right now. The next one is compensation. Right now, if you've been in a place for 1 to 5 years, the person that's redeveloping the property needs to give you 2 months' rent. If you've been there 5 to 10 years, they have to give you 3 months' rent. And 10 to 20 years, 4 months' rent. 20-plus years, 6 months' rent. So the proposal that's gone through now is if you've been there less than 5 years, it's 4 months rent, and then 5 to 10 is 5, 10 to 20 is 6. So essentially, they're adding several more months. So if I were to get renovated, I would get 4 months rent from the person that wants to, or demovicted, that wants to demolish and build something new.
All right, here's hoping for that land assembly.
Well, and so this is, it's also curious because this ties the amount of money you get to tenure. It continues to tie it to tenure. And there is a push, and I know some people in our Slack channel talked about it, and I had a conversation with Jen Bradshaw from Abundant Housing about it, and to tie it to some form of income. The mechanism there would be very difficult. And the other thing is that it doesn't give a developer any upfront concept of how much it's going to cost when they try to figure out whether or not to bulldoze. Because then they have to go about knocking on every door and saying, how much money do you make?
Those are always really popular questions to get asked.
Also, yeah. It's like it's a challenging thing because like people live in places because of the other constellation of costs that make up their financial sky.
The city also states that longer-term tenants are generally more affected by displacement due to having lower rents compared to the current market. If I moved in, I've lived in my apartment for 4 years now, I pay a way lower rate than most of the one bedrooms in my building.
Right, and that's BC's quasi-rent control system.
Not necessarily rent control, but not necessarily not rent control.
Yeah.
Yeah, my landlord has not increased my rent. And so it, like every year, I'm just like wondering around April, like, is it going to happen? And it doesn't. So I've continued to enjoy the rent of 2017, which has been quite pleasant so far as it goes.
I have nothing to say. My landlords are great, but they're also my parents, a.k.a. I still live at home.
Well, and that's more and more common too, right? And that's where the abundant housing argument really, I think, comes in, is how many people are grossly underhoused? Mm-hmm. You know, like I live in a household of two people, one bedroom, and like we make it work, but man, there's a lot of arguments about space.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also a generational thing where a lot of like people in their late 20s still live at home because rent is too expensive. Or my mom says, I'd rather you save your money for a down payment. And I burst out laughing for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But I mean, speaking of that, though, my parents are in that generation, too, where they, if the building we're in and have been in my entire life is about, is part of a land assembly itself, they looked at it and they said, why would we want to go buy another place if, you know, especially, and it's looking a lot more of the older generation as their children have moved out or moved on, why would they want to go buy another apartment or a house when they're not going to be there for quite as long?
Yeah, if they sell, like if they sell their house, they can use that money to rent for a while.
And they don't have to take care of any of the issues in their house.
I tried to talk my parents into that when they sold their house, and they were not having it. They were like, nope, we're going to buy an apartment. And that's that. Okay. You know, and they bought an apartment that cost less than they sold the house for by, you know, a fair margin. So they still got a bunch of cash. So it's not a problem there. But it is a generational thing. And I think also there is something just to be said for ethnic boundaries as well. But like there's a real culture of you own the place that you're in. And it's a sign of a not successful person that you're a renter.
Well, as a homeowner now.
Oh, God. I do love that you're going to do that every time.
Not every time. Just when it makes me feel smug. So the other half of what's come out from the city is a little bit more from the renter's office. Is that right?
Yeah. So the city's going to bring about and really implement and staff up a renter's office. It's going to have a budget and it's going to provide advice, information, and, you know, what are your rights to renters in a real meaningful way. As it stands, up until now, the only organization that really did that in a big way was TRAC, which is a tenants' rights advocacy coalition, I think is what it's called. And they are a nonprofit. But now it's going to be run out of the city. They're going to have access to city resources, and they're going to be able to, you know, assist renters in a meaningful way.
The way I can see this working is like a human rights commission or any other kind of public advocate body that is detached from government, but funded enough by government that it can advance good policy.
It seems optimistic. And once again, because I'm a stats junkie, every time you get one of these reports, there are some stats. They've broken down every neighborhood of Vancouver based on percentage of renter households. Anybody want to guess what two neighborhoods had the highest percent, which is 80 to 100% proportion of renter households in local area?
Downtown has to be one of them.
Downtown is not, but there are two areas that are considered downtown. Downtown is Yale Town and Cole Harbour. And the West End, which is, I think, what you were probably leaning into, is the 80 to 100%.
Okay.
All right. So Strathcona?
Strathcona is the other one, the basically straddling the downtown core. And then the next two most common, which are in the 60 to 60-80% rental household bands.
Kitsilano?
Actually, no. Surprisingly, Kits is only 40 to 60%. But still, like 40 to 60% of Kits residents are renters.
Sunrise.
False Creek?
It's Mount Pleasant, which includes Falls Creek still for reasons that are confusing and make demographic analysis of the Mount Pleasant area really weird. And Grandview Woodland. Grandview Woodland again.
Who would have thunk it?
The areas at the lowest are, there's a number of them that are, you know, 20 to 40%. No area is 0 to 20% though. But the areas that are 20 to 40% are the areas you would think they would be. Victoria Fraser View, West Point Grey, Dunbar, Arbutus Ridge, etc.
Where does Sunset fit?
Sunset is 40 to 60%.
All right.
Yeah. It's interesting. Oak Ridge is actually in the lowest end of the band, but I'm guessing in 10 years that will vary significantly.
There's the whole Canby redevelopment and the Marple Oak Ridge transportation hub that's going in there.
Yep. And then also the old TransLink bus bay. The other one that's really interesting is income distribution of renter households, 2005 to 2015 comparison. This one is one where we saw over the last 10 years, from 2005 to 2015, a significant increase in the percentage of renters who are actually in higher income bands, which is not really surprising, I think, when you think about it. Essentially, new household formulation of renters were have more money. And, you know, I'm one of them. In 2005, I was not a renter in Vancouver, and now I am. And our household income is fairly healthy because we both have good union jobs. So, you know, it's interesting to think about the idea that renters are becoming also more affluent, which changes the political dynamic as well.
Well, and also there's no houses that even middle to middle upper class can afford in Vancouver to buy.
Nearly 10% of renters are now earning over 150K as a household income.
But does that also speak to the transient population, just as like people, it's easier to move and renting is the easier option if you're when you're wanting to move, especially for relocation for jobs?
Yeah, if you're an in-demand tech worker, why would you buy a house here when you're gonna maybe, it's a really good point.
The only in-demand person who works for a technology company that seems to have bought a house here is Meng Wanzhou.
I feel like that's a different type of in-demand.
You know, you make these jokes and I always wonder if we're gonna get letters.
It's not a letter your work should be worried about. It's a visit.
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's a better point. But yeah, so those were both interesting. So, you know, Renters Advocacy Group is going to be really valuable, especially because I think it's going to be really focused on the people that are really hardest hit. And that's, you know, important. Renters are precarious in Vancouver.
Well, those are some issues with long-term renters. But seems like another community in the GVRD has some issues with a short-term renter. Let's head up to Anmore.
So there's this lovely story about...
Did you just call it lovely?
Yes, I did. About a party...
Lush?
That we all wish we could have been at.
Liquid?
I feel like that's...
Yeah, I don't know that I would have wanted it. I would have enjoyed the helicopter ride to get there.
I would have enjoyed like a live stream to watch from my bed.
According to the social media posts of one Justin Plotz, the host of said party... This party featured 1,700 cans of booze, 526 ounces of whiskey, 333 attendees, 7 supercars, 6 police cars, 5 hypercars, 3 helicopters, 2 ambulances, and a fire truck.
And fire truck, too.
It's like a really convoluted seven days of Christmas.
Yeah. So it was a free party to go to that wrapped up at like 10:30, apparently, because it started out noon or something.
Also, like a... you have to get people home by transit still at some point.
They have helicopters.
Well, there were three options to get there. People were presented with three options to get there. Either a yacht that would take you from downtown Vancouver to Anmore, or a helicopter, or there were people that were shuttling supercars, whatever the hell those are, back and forth.
So supercars and hypercars, I'm fascinated to know what the difference is between the two. And also, why... Who builds the third helicopter pad?
Well, no, they weren't using a pad. They were using the backyard.
Yeah, there were no pads.
So the mayor of Anmore has lodged a complaint with Transport Canada, and Transport Canada is investigating whether or not they followed proper safety protocols when it comes to landing in somebody's backyard, because apparently there's safety protocols for that.
So to answer your question about what the difference between a supercar and a hypercar is,
yes,
all hypercars are supercars, but not all supercars are hypercars.
Fantastic. Okay.
It's so, philosophy 101.
So hypercars are like cooler supercars, presumably, or more expensive.
So I am Googling this as we speak. It is coined to qualify the top 1% of supercars.
We are the 99% of supercars.
So like a Lambo, like a Lamborghini is probably a supercar, but there's something more expensive that I don't know what it is because you have to
like
be in that
income. Like a McLaren P1, Ferrari LaFerrari, or Porsche 918 all have nearly 1,000 horsepower.
Isn't it Porsche 911? Isn't
that? No, that's the one.
That's
the 99.
Oh, that's the pleb car.
That's
the
one for plebs.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they all have nearly 1,000 horsepower with first-class new-age technology, million-dollar price tags, stunning design, and performance rivaled only by each other.
They cost more than
the house.
My income over a 20-year run?
I'm pretty sure that some of those cars probably cost more than the house they threw the party in.
But how many of the cars had N stickers on the back?
All of them?
Now, I am just going to say, why are we still measuring things in horsepower? Like, why are we planning on going back to horses at some point? This is
like it's a measurement I can understand. Okay,
yeah. Like I did,
it just makes sense. I think I know exactly how much a horse can power.
I grew up on a farm. I have seen horses.
I've rode one on a pony ride once. I think it was an actual horse.
I was rider of the week at horse camp once.
He wins.
So, but like. Okay, and this just
are we
allows...
gonna keep going on horsepower, or are we can just, we get back
to
the
just,
party?
Just one. No. It's an urban planning reference. Apparently, the number one concern at the first Congress of Urban Planning was what to do with all the horse shit.
So, giant party in Anmore. The mayor and all the community are upset. There's lots of phone calls. There was an overdose on site, hence the ambulances. And what is Vancouver now? Is Vancouver just like a weird place for the super rich?
At times, parts. Well, this was Anmore, which barely qualifies.
It's Vancouver adjacent.
Yeah. What I enjoy, though, is the political angle of the mayor's comments where he initially blamed the speculation tax for this.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to know how that plays into.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah. So his argument, as far as I can parse it, is the speculation tax means the owner of the property had to let it out so that it would be occupied enough that he wouldn't pay the tax.
It's an owner that would only be there for, say, 3 months of the year or a couple of weekends of the year when they feel like it at this giant mansion. And because of the need to keep it occupied for a period of time, they're now subletting it for, you know, a couple months here, a couple months there, and they would have otherwise left it empty, and that this is the problem.
Didn't West Van have a similar issue with a house party thrown by a bunch of high school students who used it from Airbnb?
That's right, the trashed house. I forgot about that.
Yeah, so how would that... I'm pretty sure that was pre-speculation tax, too.
Yep.
Rich kids will do stupid shit. That's the end of my point.
I think when you're a mayor of a small town and you have a chance to get your digs at a political party that's governing your province that you disagree with, why would you ever turn it down?
Well, seems like the super rich are coming to Vancouver, but there's a couple of things that might bring some nature lovers to Vancouver, and that is the topic of this week's Vancouverada.
Whales?
Whales.
Whales.
Free Willy.
Well, is this the Prince of Wales or...
Oh, the Trump tweet.
I had to get that in there.
Okay, no, fill me in. I have deliberately excluted Trump tweets from the media zone, so...
Trump tweeted how he had a meeting with the Prince of Wales, spelled W-H-A-L-E.
Ah.
He did capitalize the W.
Yeah, at least he got that. I do love that the Welsh Daily... Wales Daily Mail, or whatever the paper there is, did change their Twitter name to Wales Online, W-H-A-L-E.
Maybe he was talking about the Victoria Whale Watching Company, which brings us back to the orca pod that was spotted yesterday in False Creek.
Four bigs, or transient orcas, as they're called, rolled their way into False Creek yesterday afternoon and made a big splash. So the differentiation I'd like to make is that there's three, broadly speaking, species of orca. There's a lot of consideration that they might be actually fully separate species. They don't commingle. They don't breed together. They don't do anything like that. So there's offshore whales who operate in pods of 80 to 100 or 200 at times. This is something I get really nerdy about. There's transient orcas, which operate off just all over the place. And the transients primarily and exclusively feed on marine mammals, whereas the local southern residents feed exclusively on salmon, more or less. And so the transient population is booming in the Pacific Northwest because there's a booming population of seals. And it's baby seal season right now. And so that's the prime delicacy of transient whales who rolled into False Creek and swam right in on the hunt for some seals.
Transient whales, much more sensible than the European Union. I support the seal hunt. Go on.
Oh my God, really?
So this is not the first time whales have been spotted in False Creek, which is not a normal whale habitat. It's a very small body of water, but it is salt water, so they can make their way in.
Yeah, a juvenile gray whale swam into False Creek in 2010 and went all the way out to past the Cambie Street Bridge and wowed visitors for, I think, a full solid day. Yeah. Whereas in this situation, the whales were only came in, maybe caught a seal or two and went back out again about an hour later.
It's nice because it's like the 7-year anniversary of the dead whale of White Rock. So,
well, that's depressing. But yeah, it's also
the recent dead whales of White Rock actually weren't dead. They survived. So they're not dead at all.
All right. Well, and as the Vancouverada, I think it really speaks to the testament of False Creek being a bounce back revival waterland. Waterland? Water area. And so False Creek was essentially dead to all life for a long time because the two primary industries on False Creek was shipbuilding and...
Poison?
Poison, essentially, because it was pulp and paper mills.
Yeah.
Both of which are ridiculously polluting. And so those two industries combined to sort of kill off most of the life of False Creek. And it's really made a bounce back. So we've now got 5 or 6 years, I think it is now, of herring returning to False Creek. And notably, last year when the herring returned to Squamish Inlet there, a pod of white-sided dolphins followed them in to eat herring, which might happen at False Creek at some point. And so this is a really interesting bounce back that we're having.
I've been trying, just racking my brain for like a gentrification, like, pun to make for like the aquatic landscape. I've done it too. God damn it, the aquatic landscape. All right. Well, but I can't find it. So
my big takeaway was some of those photos are going to sell a lot of money of tourist dollars coming to Vancouver now. Those photos are absolutely stunning. If you haven't seen them, which you must be living under a rock, but if you haven't seen them, Google the whales of False Creek because it is.
Or just go on Twitter.
Yeah, or just go on Twitter because it is phenomenal.
I spend my time off Twitter. But if you want to find us on Twitter, I am at Naylor Forex. Zoe, where can people find you?
Zoe.Ferry.
And also Majority of BC at?
We don't have a Twitter account. We have an Instagram account. It's
cool.
At Majority of BC.
And we do have a question that we ask all of our guests, and that is, what is your favorite park in Vancouver?
That's a tough one.
You can't say Stanley Park. I mean, you can, but we'll make fun of
it. It is the most cheater of answers.
I like Queen Elizabeth Park.
Okay, why?
On a sunny day, you get a lovely view of Mount Baker. You can, lovely view of the city. It's a lot quieter during the week because it's a bit of a trek up there.
Yeah.
But it's a great walk and a great running trail.
Surprisingly, you're the first person, I think, to say Queen Elizabeth Park.
I was just there over the weekend. I was like, oh, this is so beautiful.
Yeah, great.
Well, listeners, remember to take our survey at cambyreport.ca/survey. Support us at patreon.com/cambyreport.
Patreon.com/cambyreport. Patreon.com/cambyreport. Patreon.com/cambyreport. Good night.